Minnesota Public Radio's live coverage of President Mikhail Gorbachev's visit to the Twin Cities is made possible by the international public relations consulting firm of Padilla Spear Beardsley. 1 minute before 5 o'clock as we await the arrival of the Gorbachev motorcade in downtown Minneapolis. Commentators Patty Dale and Evelyn David Heiser are here. I can't read my handwriting, and I can't remember anything anymore. Thank you, folks, so much for coming in. Patty, I know you've got to take off shortly. What's your impression overall of this trip so far that you've seen today?
It has clearly been a success. Ultimately, the success will be tested in the business response that comes because of it. I was intrigued to find Robert Maxwell as part of the retinue. I was unaware of his participation. But that is an indication of Gorbachev's ability to attract the attention and mobilize some of the leading businessmen of the world. They are taking him seriously.
Do you think that more is accomplished by having him come to Minnesota than just having him visit with, or just having trade discussions and political discussions among business leaders, not at the presidential level?
Yes, it is important for him to get out of Washington. The whole of American industrial and technological enterprise is not concentrated within the Beltway. It is here in Minnesota, it is there in California, it is elsewhere. Gorbachev has come to meet American business leaders, is doing so. That Maxwell was there is an indicator that he's being taken seriously. Ultimately, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating, in how much extra economic interaction is produced between Minnesota and the Soviet Union because of it. Yes, I think it's been a successful visit.
Evelyn David Heiser, what do you think about the prospects for additional trade between this part of the country and the Soviet Union?
Well, a lot depends on the problem of ruble convertibility, and as some people have put it, commodity convertibility. But I think it's critical that he move the economic aspects of his visit to the United States away from Washington, to move the economic away from the political. The problem with most favored nation status has been political, not economic. Certainly, yeah. There's business enthusiasm for that. So by going to San Francisco, by going to Minneapolis, and concentrating on the economic outside of Washington, he moves towards separating that from the political relations between the two countries.
Well, it seems that in the effort to have the various business leaders and the former agriculture secretaries urge most favored nation trade status, that he is trying to develop a constituency outside of Washington. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he will succeed in doing that. I know Senator Boschwitz, for one, has not been terribly enthusiastic about that most favored nation trade status until we see some improvement in the Lithuanian situation and the human rights generally.
Well, yes, I mean that continues to be a problem. The question is, if enough business leaders start lobbying, do people like Senator Boschwitz start listening to the business leaders? And
mm-hmm. All right, 2 minutes past 5 o'clock. Thanks, Evelyn. Patty Dale, I know you have to take off. Thank you so much for coming down here and spending several hours with us today.
My pleasure.
It's been very interesting. Patty Dale is from St. Olaf College in Northfield. He is a political scientist there who specializes in the Soviet Union and directs the Soviet Studies program at St. Olaf. Thanks a lot. And Evelyn, you're going to hang in here for a while and visit with us as we continue. Right through the bitter end, right?
Through the bitter end.
All right, terrific. President Gorbachev's trip to Minnesota has been described primarily as a business trip. One theory is that his visit is in part to express his appreciation for the loyalty shown by some Minnesota companies to the Soviet Union. There is a lot of talk about all the business opportunities available in the Soviet Union. But for all the opportunities, the Soviet system also presents some serious hurdles. One of the biggest is the currency, the ruble, which, exactly as Patty and Evelyn have said, is not convertible. Richard Bohr, Director of International Trade for the Minnesota Trade Office, says that currency and other matters cloud the trade picture with the Soviets.
You know, it's problematic right now. We hear stories about payments by the Soviets to Western companies being frozen because the Soviets are desperately short of foreign exchange. That has not been a problem until this point. The Soviets have been very prompt with their payments. But you're right, Bob, there is that shortage of foreign currency, which for the time being, anyhow, is going to put more and more emphasis on counter trade, barter trade, and those kinds of arrangements which inspire entrepreneurs to be creative and imaginative.
We know that they can, that they have plenty of vodka that they can
Absolutely.
Export. How about oil? Is that a practical thing? Could they load up oil in tankers and ship it across?
Well, that has been a primary export for the Soviets, but we understand there, too, that sources of oil are beginning to shrink here and there in the Soviet Union. So the long-term viability of oil looks a little doubtful, at least for the moment.
We're told the Soviets reward loyalty and that companies like Cargill, Control Data, Archer Daniels, and some have been loyal. But is there a point, in your view, when businesses should react to a country's violation of human rights and essentially stop doing trade, bring some power of the purse to bear?
I think that a number of Minnesotans have gone that route, particularly during the 1970s. A number of Minnesota companies continue to hold back because of that issue. But as the Soviet Union increases its immigration to Israel and to other countries.
Going to fade out of Richard Bohr here, Director of the Minnesota Trade Office, so that we can check in with Chris Tetlin, who has the motorcade in sight. And actually, we're going to Lauren.
Yes,
down
Bob.
At Radisson Plaza.
Yes, Bob. I'm directly across the street now from the entrance to the Radisson Plaza. The limousine bearing President Gorbachev has just pulled up and pulled into the their drive. There's a circular driveway there that goes in front of the Radisson front door. As he drove by us here on 7th Street, he could see him leaning forward, leaning toward the window, waving to the crowd of reporters on the street. And he was beaming, I think is the only way you could describe it, smiling from ear to ear as he drove by, waved, and they immediately whisked him around into the driveway. And we can just see through the pieces of banner here what's going on.
Lauren, what is that yelling I hear in the background? Do you hear that?
That barking, yes. That barking is apparently a Secret Service agent, some sort of security, moving cars around, showing cars where to go, showing buses where to go. He's obviously very upset.
That
bus is not where it belongs.
No, that fellow does not sound like he's from Minnesota. He's not being very polite.
he looks like he's from Minnesota, Bob.
Does he really?
Yeah, he doesn't really have that appropriate sort. Yes, and what the bus he's yelling at is the bus full of these business leaders, various dignitaries, a lot of them carrying these Euro bags, as they're known, you know, these shiny plastic bags that you often see in department stores and that kind of thing. And now we're seeing the bus here, the large sort of executive limousine getting out of the way, and that's what he was trying to
I see via the pool video feed there, Gorbachev in a welcoming line. I saw him just greeted by Kurt Carlson of the Carlson Companies, and he is now making his way down the line, visiting with some of the other people there who are greeting him at the Radisson Plaza.
I'm sorry, Bob. I lost you there for a second.
I'm just saying that my observation from the pool video here is that Gorbachev is being greeted by some people at the Radisson Plaza, among them Kurt Carlson, and I trust that he'll be going inside there quite shortly.
Yes, I think it's so. It is. We have been informed, by the way, that some of the biggest of the big shots, as it were, the out-of-town people, the Lee Iacocca's of the world, the Roger Smiths, for example, were not able to make it to the meeting today, or
is that right?
Shown up. That's right, and that apparently has made room for some more lesser big shots, as it were. More Minnesotans apparently getting in. Harvey McKay, for example, who was originally left off the list, now is going to be in that meeting, and a number of other people were told. There's an advertising executive from Iowa, for example, who is now going to be taking part in the meeting because of these vacancies created by the nationally known celebrities not showing up.
Well, as I understand it, one of Harvey's books, I think the first one, was probably translated into Russian and did quite well over there.
That's what I've heard, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine he might be a popular guest there. By the way, he's seated at the same table with Jack Grundhofer, First Bank, so maybe they'll find something common to talk about.
I imagine there'll be a lot of meeting of the minds down there at the Radisson Plaza later on today.
Mm-hmm. No Soviets at the table with Harvey McKay that we can see, by the way.
Now, the interesting thing is that apparently, despite Gorbachev's penchant for getting out of the vehicle and talking to people, he did not do that.
No.
On his way down to the plaza this afternoon.
Well, what we saw here was about the last block and a half of the motorcade as it whisked down 7th Street. Looked like to be like it was going about all of 30 miles an hour even when it whisked through the final corner there at the Nicollet Mall. And as I say, what we saw in the press corps was Gorbachev pressed up against the window of the limousine, smiling broadly, waving, and then just a brief flash as he went by and made that U-turn into the Radisson driveway.
Is it your understanding, Lauren, that the meeting is still going to be open to broadcast coverage?
That's the latest information we have, Bob. Yeah, we double-checked that with the press office, the folks who are coordinating this Gorbachev visit. They tell us that, as best they know, they're not sure where that report that you had came from, that the meeting would be closed, but as best they know, the meeting will be open, and it will be available on that pool audio feed.
Very good. Well, I hope that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Lauren, well, keep us up to date. If you see anything interesting down there, why, holler back at us.
Okay, right now I think I'm seeing the same thing you are, which is sort of a wide shot of the meeting room, people seated at various round tables, mm-hmm. various business leaders awaiting the arrival of Gorbachev.
And as I understand it, Lauren, Gorbachev, this meeting actually will not get started for about 35 minutes yet. As I understand it, he has a little rest time there down at the hotel.
That's what we've been told, too. They call it private time, but basically it's kind of a chance for President and Mrs. Gorbachev to recoup. They have a couple of rooms reserved for them at the Radisson, and apparently that's exactly what they're going to do, is what anybody else would do after a long trip, just kind of go and freshen up a little bit, maybe splash a little cold water on their face and sit around and rest their legs.
Digest that big meal that they had at the governor's
mansion. That breaded walleye I've heard so much about, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. All right. It is 11 minutes past 5 o'clock as our live coverage of the Gorbachev trip to Minnesota continues. We sort of interrupted a conversation midway with Richard Bohr of the Minnesota Trade Office in order to catch up on the arrival of the motorcade in downtown Minneapolis. Richard Bohr has a number of interesting comments to make, and I think it might be worth our while to go back and listen to some of them. Do you think it's any of our business in Minnesota whether or not the various republics get independence? We have heard throughout the course of, and will hear throughout the course of the afternoon today, from some of the ethnic groups that are backing independence for their republics. Is that any of our business, or should we just pretty much say, well, that's their affair, let them deal with it as they will?
I think Minnesotans have always regarded that issue as Minnesotans' business. Many Minnesotans have been vocal in that area, and there are ways that Minnesotans can bring a pressure to bear in those areas to get Mr. Gorbachev to respond one way or the other.
Do you think they should do it at the meeting today?
I'm sure that President Gorbachev is going to be fully aware of the issues that a number of Minnesotans will bring to him.
Mm-hmm. How much U.S. red tape and bureaucracy is a problem with trade with the Soviets? Or is most of the trade, or most of the red tape and bureaucracy an issue of theirs?
I think on both sides, Bob, red tape is becoming less problematic. On the Soviet side, in the old days, of course, you'd just go to Minister Ivan and try to find a factory through a centralized bureaucracy that wanted to buy your ball bearings. Now, of course, the power has been radically decentralized, pushed downward from ministers at the top all the way down to, in many cases, the factory level. So that means easier access for the Minnesota business person. Of course, the trick is to get to the right factory, to get to the right manager. But that seems to be working a lot better because it does cut bureaucratic time, and it does enable Minnesotans, if they're astute, to find the end users. Also, on the American side, as the Cold War wanes, there is obviously less and less a strategic concern for the technology that we used to want to export, but which could not go forward because of export controls. And so the process is going to be considerably simplified in coming years because those strategic issues will evaporate over time.
Do you think the most favored nation trade status is really going to make a significant difference in terms of Minnesota trade with the Soviet Union?
I do, Bob, because it will enable, as I said earlier, the tariffs on Soviet imports into our country to be radically reduced.
Mm-hmm.
The more we can buy from the Soviets, the more money we can put in their pocket so that they can then buy more of our goods and services.
Mm-hmm. The Radisson Hotel venture was announced a few days ago, I guess. Northwest Airlines is seeking greater access to Soviet airspace and so on. What have you been hearing on the grapevine in terms of the other things that might be coming along?
We know that there are more high technology joint ventures in the works, particularly in the area of computers, testing equipment, instrumentation. These joint ventures seem to be, again, areas where we have a particularly good mesh with developments in the Soviet Union. We're also going to see, Bob, more joint ventures and joint developments in medical care, procedures of one kind or another, where the Soviets are very, very good and where we might not be quite so advanced, the procedure to correct nearsightedness, for example. And we're going to see more and more research and development in areas of very very keen concern to both of us, in education, for example, computer-enhanced education, in service training, in management. And I think that one of the most exciting potentials on the horizon is the creation in Moscow of an institute on entrepreneurship. And if Minnesotans aren't entrepreneurial, they're nothing.
That's Richard Bohr, director of the Minnesota Trade Office, in a conversation I had with him a couple of days ago. It's about 15 minutes past 5 o'clock as our live coverage of the Gorbachev trip to Minnesota continues. I think you may hear, yes, you hear it now, in the background. That's the sound of the room where the meeting with the business leaders is going to be held about half an hour from now. President Gorbachev is at the Radisson Plaza Hotel in downtown Minneapolis. He and Mrs. Gorbachev have a rest period scheduled for about a half an hour. Then they will begin the meeting with the business leaders, and that is expected to last until, about 7 o'clock or so. Then they'll be leaving the Radisson for Control Data Headquarters in Bloomington. That's off Interstate 494 there, down around 34th Avenue or so, not too terribly far from the airport. From the Control Data meeting, they will go to the airport. They'll be at Control Data for, 35, 40 minutes, something like that, looking at a computer display, meeting with perhaps the head of Control Data, Mr. Perlman, and then they eventually will be making their way back to the airport and getting on their flight for San Francisco. If you have not heard about other events today, prior to coming to Minnesota, President Gorbachev and President Bush held a news conference in Washington. The two declared their summit a success, and they said they will meet with each other on a regular basis. They confirmed their impasse over the military shape of a united Germany. Gorbachev also warned Israel that he would consider suspending issuing exit permits for Soviet Jews if they continue to be settled on the West Bank or in Gaza. Bush also added the disagreement over the Kremlin's treatment of Lithuania and other Baltic republics that want independence. There was also a quick reminder of Gorbachev's political difficulties at home. He was asked by a reporter for the government newspaper Izvestia about his relationship with Boris Yeltsin. And to that question, Gorbachev replied, and I quote, "I don't think you've chosen the best place for clarifying our internal problems," unquote. Gorbachev described the summit as one of enormous importance and said he has invited Bush to make a state visit to the Soviet Union. The two leaders reached a number of agreements at the summit, among them one to ban production of chemical weapons. They agreed on a framework toward a treaty on cutting nuclear arms. And in a concession to Gorbachev, they agreed on a pact to normalize trade relations between the two countries for the first time in 50 years. At the news conference, Gorbachev embraced several new commercial agreements, mentioning IBM and Chevron by name. In their prepared statements, they both touched on the success of the summit, Gorbachev listing a fistful of agreements. They also made clear they continue to disagree on the future of a united Germany. Despite their differences, the presidents agreed the summit had done wonders for their working relationship. Bush said he and Gorbachev have achieved a spirit of candor and openness. Gorbachev said the talks in Washington made it possible to speak of a new phase of cooperation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. He acknowledged there are differences, and questions were quickly put to the leaders about festering disagreements on Germany and Lithuania. Bush said that Lithuania was indeed one of the thorns in the side of the overall relationship. He said the trade agreement he and Gorbachev signed on Friday won't go to Congress without Soviet enactment of liberalized immigration laws. Bush said he received no assurance from Gorbachev that the Soviets will lift their economic sanctions against Lithuania. So those are some of the highlights of the news conference that Presidents Bush and Gorbachev had just before President Gorbachev took off from Washington en route to Minnesota. There were just a couple of changes in the Gorbachev trip to Minnesota. First of all, the plane arrived a little bit later than expected. Possibly that's because they left Washington a little later than expected, and that might also have been due to the fact that there are such strong winds from the west-northwest that may have slowed the aircraft down a little bit. Sometimes, I know I've been on flights when that's been the case, you sometimes get a headwind and it slows you down, and you get a tailwind and it speeds you up. The other thing, major change in the Soviet president's itinerary, is the cancellation of the trip to the Brand Farm. The word came not long after President Gorbachev arrived in the Twin Cities that the party was not, in fact, going to go down and visit the Richard Brand Farm in Farmington, apparently because the Soviets were simply too tired. I had a chance to visit with John Brand, the son of the owner of the farm, and he said that, indeed, the family was pretty disappointed with what happened. After all, they spent a lot of time getting ready for it. Some of their relatives had driven for as long as 12 hours to be down on the farm to have a chance to visit with Gorbachev. But he said that, indeed, if they were offered the opportunity of hosting another major world leader, that, yes, by golly, they'd go through with it and they'd get ready and they'd give it their best. So, 21 minutes now, past 5 o'clock, our live coverage continues here on Minnesota Public Radio. We've canceled all of our regular scheduled programs until the Gorbachev plane leaves sometime after 8 o'clock this evening. The visit of Gorbachev to the North American continent is certainly gaining widespread coverage for him back at home. But a Radio Moscow reporter we talked to said it would be a mistake to overstate the interest of the Soviet people in the Gorbachev trip. We talked with Irina Solotsova. She's a reporter and editor for Radio Moscow's North American service. She said the popularity of Gorbachev has slipped at home, that the Soviet people are looking for action on economic reform.
The popularity of Gorbachev now compared to his popularity several years ago has to be looked upon from different angles. When he won office, when he came into power, the entire life in this country was so much different from the way it is now that he was perceived as probably as a savior, in a sense, as a man who was determined to see change in this country. And of course he was hailed and welcomed, and he enjoyed really quite a high level of support, unanimous support. But for the opposition, of course, which has always been there, although had a different, maybe, character several years ago than it has now. Right now, the things have changed, and he is saying that he is going through a decline, that he's losing popularity. He's probably saying showing just one side of the picture, because there is always, it's a very complicated picture, a complex picture. You have to know all the other aspects to it. One is that today he is looked upon as a man who should act. And, you know, the major achievement of the last 5 years in this country has, of course, been associated with glasnost and openness in the political sphere rather than the economic sphere. The economic reform, which has been talked about for so long a time right now, has been stalling. Because probably there hasn't been anything like an economic reform in the proper sense of the word. So right now, I think, because things are so bad in the economic sphere, in the economic aspect, he is expected to act more swiftly, more radically in the economy. And on that, I think, much of his popularity hinges right at the moment. I don't think he is losing popularity on, you know, verging on being toppled or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Although prognosis to that effect abound in other countries, and some of the people here are talking about it. I don't think he's really losing the grip on power at the moment. I think he is trying to grapple with too many problems at the moment, and that's not something he is to blame, because the overall situation has been too complex to be put to right over a short period of time.
Is his trip to Minnesota being viewed with any interest by the people over in the Soviet Union?
Well, I think like any trip of the first president of the country, of course, is looked upon with some aspiration and hope for the better. Of course, for many people here, the summit in Washington, which is going on now, and anything that goes beyond the boundaries of the Soviet Union has a slightly minor importance than their own immediate needs and preoccupations. And people are so very much preoccupied by their current problems at the moment that perhaps one of the people I talked the other day to said a summit in Washington is like a sideshow. So perhaps it is right in a sense that, you know, people are looking upon his trip to the U.S. as something they can hopefully benefit from. And if they can, the interest at least will be growing. If not, if things that are decided there will only have a side effect on their everyday life, then, of course, you know, interest tends to dwindle.
Irina Solotsova, reporter and editor for the North American Service of Radio Moscow. I should explain that she is not part of the media entourage following Gorbachev around North America. Rather, she is helping hold down the fort back at Radio Moscow's headquarters. We may be hearing from her a little bit later this afternoon, too. I must say parenthetically what an interesting woman she is, and particularly considering the fact that she is only 26 years old. Yes, 26 years old. Her English is just amazing. She spent some time in Britain, she told me, but she has not been to the United States, and yet she has absolutely flawless English, understood everything that I was certainly able to say to her, and I thought was able to speak in a very forthright and very clear fashion about some complex issues. 26 years old kind of makes you a little bit scared, doesn't it? It's 27 minutes past 5 o'clock. We have the new weather forecasts out for Minnesota, and we'll get to those after we pause just for a little break. And it's 28 minutes after 5 o'clock. Our live broadcast of the Gorbachev trip to Minnesota continues. And Gary Eichten is back from the state capitol. You don't look all frozen, Gary. Must not have been too bad out there.
Well, thawed out, Bob.
You've thawed out.
Thawed out a little bit.
It was nippy.
It was nippy.
Yeah.
But it was well worth the experience. And I talked to several people after the motorcade had left. Of course, he didn't stop at the capitol, so
no.
People didn't have a chance to get out and talk with him and touch him and stuff. But to a person, they all said, boy, this was well worth the wait. And some of them had been there since, you know, 10, 11 o'clock this morning through several rainstorms, through biting winds.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm. Are you a little bit surprised about that, Evelyn David Heiser, that these people would stand there for so long just to get a glimpse of a guy that, you know, they'll never meet?
Well, when we talked about it earlier, I had a great explanation for why the crowds were so small. Now you're asking for an explanation of why all these people were there.
Well, they were. I do think the crowds were. I was still surprised there weren't more people there. You know, maybe mm-hmm. there were. I'm not good at crowd estimates. I would guess maybe 5,000 people up there. Mm-hmm. But when you think about the Twins drawing 150 or 200 or whatever it was up there,
yeah,
it's quite a difference.
Hmm. And it is nice to see that kind of turnout, as you were saying earlier, for an international political figure rather than, you know, a rock star, a Hollywood celebrity. It's kind of reassuring to see that sort of outpouring by the American population.
Mm-hmm. 5:30 is the time. We've got some new weather information. Might as well pass that along here. What we're waiting for is the start of that business meeting down at the Radisson Plaza Hotel. That should theoretically get underway at about 6:15 here, and indications are that it will be available for live broadcast, and we certainly will be bringing you that. But if you thought it was a little bit chilly today, wait till tonight. There is, believe it or not, a frost advisory in effect for the northern and eastern portions of Minnesota tonight. Cloudiness will decrease and skies will clear later on. Frost is possible with lows mainly in the 30s, some low 40s possible in the southwest. Chance of showers tomorrow afternoon in western Minnesota. Highs will be mainly in the 60s with some low 70s possible in the southwest. Then Monday night, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain statewide, lows in the 40s and 50s. For the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, frost advisory for tonight. Temperatures falling through the 40s with mostly clear skies. To 30 Tuesday, partly cloudy, 20% chance of showers, and temperatures getting a little more seasonable by Tuesday, up to the low to mid-70s. Around the area right now, St. Cloud is cloudy and 50 degrees. At Rochester, cloudy 48, the wind from the north gusting to 33. Duluth Superior, mostly sunny and 50, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul, now 51 degrees. Cloudy skies, the wind northwest gusting to 25 miles per hour. One expert says that the rate of emigration from the Soviet Union has expanded beyond anyone's predictions. Minnesota, he says, has one of the highest rates of Soviet emigre resettlement. Robert Aronson is an immigration attorney in Minneapolis. For years, he's studied the Soviet Union. He speaks the language and, as he puts it, has a deep affection for the country. Robert Aronson credits Mikhail Gorbachev with turning around the Soviet Union's position on allowing its residents to leave. I spoke with him at his law office in Minneapolis. Aronson is most familiar with Jewish emigres from the Soviet Union.
The whole rate of immigration is escalating beyond anyone's wildest dreams. As an example, 1985 was one of the low water marks in immigration. Less than 1,000 Soviet Jews emigrated from the Soviet Union. This year alone, in April, roughly 13,000 Soviet Jews came out of the Soviet Union. We're looking at immigration flows, certainly to the United States over the next year, of roughly 40,000. Actually, it's 50 to 60,000 Soviet Jews, and at minimally 10,000 other nationalities who face a well-founded fear of persecution. In addition to that, immigration to Israel is anticipated to top 100,000 in 1990. This is absolutely unprecedented.
Approximately how many Jews are there in the Soviet Union?
Estimates vary. Officially, there are 1.8 million Jews. But it depends on how you define a Jew. With the chance that Soviet Jews have a certain favored position in leaving the Soviet Union, the population of Soviet Jewry is increasing progressively. By some estimates, it may even reach 7 million. So it's somewhere between 5 million, 1.8 million, 7 million. Most responsible estimates put it at about 3 million.
Well, still, it seems clear that, based on those numbers, that the majority of people, the majority of Soviet Jews, are not trying to immigrate, are they?
In strict terms of majority, no. The United States, though, the Embassy of the United States has issued approximately 500,000, they're called preliminary applications. That is the initial document which begins the immigration process. In addition to that, there are certainly the immigration flow to Israel for this year will be about 100,000. The feeling is that that will continue to escalate. So in a strict strict numerical sense, no, not everyone wants to leave, but certainly a disproportionate amount to the population are looking to leave.
Kind of a digression, we'll get back on the main point, but the emigration of all those Soviet Jews to Israel and their settlement on the West Bank and the occupied territory seems to be causing a great deal of difficulty. What are your views on that?
Well, it has become a political football. There's no question about that. But the fact is that less than 0.5% of Soviet emigres are resettling on the occupied territories. 70%, statistically, roughly 70% of the Soviet Jews going to Israel are settling within the established metropolitan areas, Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. There's where the jobs are. Those are the areas which can more or less replicate the type of life they were used to in the Soviet Union, highly urbanized, job-oriented. I believe that the entire balance of power is not being affected by the immigration of Soviet Jewry to the Mideast.
How many of those people come to the United States? Well, you said about 40,000 the coming year, but how many come to Minnesota, and why do they come here?
In terms of numbers, the Twin Cities area has been extremely generous in terms of its hospitality to not only Soviet Jews, but nationalities from throughout the world. We have the highest per capita resettlement of Soviet Jewry in the United States. There are, in this past year, in the Twin Cities, roughly 500 individuals have come from the Soviet Union. The reasons, mainly it's family connection, that is, anchor families who can support and help them over the immigration stage.
What kind of people are they? What is their background? What are their skills? What do they want to do?
In this current wave, the wave which is now coming to the United States, they're disproportionately professional in their orientation. In other words, what you have is really the middle class giving up on the Soviet Union and making the really radical step of immigration. They are highly oriented toward computer job skills, physics, the hard sciences, music. Number of excellent musicians have immigrated within the past year.
Do you suspect that perhaps the Soviet authorities, recognizing this brain drain of a sort, are going to try to make life a little more appealing for those folks so that they'll not want to leave?
I think that there's a general desire to make life more palatable in the Soviet Union, but I think that the problems of that country are perhaps now intractable. That is, the Soviet Union, in the process of adopting and conforming its behavior to certain norms of international behavior, have been forced to open up its immigration doors. And given that possibility, more and more Jews are deciding to leave the Soviet Union. I think that that general tendency is going to continue to escalate.
Tell me a little about your most recent trip over there, and when was that?
Yeah, I just got back from the Soviet Union less than 2 weeks ago. I was there on a very meaningful, interesting project to me. I was putting together a study for national broadcast on the situation of Soviet Jewry and the position of Soviet Jewry vis-a-vis the rise of Russian nationalism. During that period of time, visited Moscow, Leningrad, and Riga, was with a television crew, and met during the course of that trip with the current Jewish leadership within the Soviet Union, the cultural revivalists among the Jewish community, members of the Latvian Jewish community, as well as various government and quasi-official representatives, many of them being on the Russian nationalistic side.
What did you learn from them?
I think that Jewish life today is being shaped by four forces. And I think that in light of those four forces, the tendency toward enhanced immigration will continue to escalate. First of all, under Glasnost, there's a general tendency in the Soviet Union today toward an enhanced self-realization of nationalist identity. You see it among Soviet Jews, but you also see it under other nationalities. That is, scientific communism has proven itself bankrupt. People are looking back into their own ethnic roots to take self-definition. Number two, growing out of this you have the outgrowth of Russian nationalism, and a particularly virulent stream of Russian nationalism, which has as one of its central tenets anti-Semitism. In the course of Glasnost and the country being opened up to an increased form of populism, you have a much greater manifestation of anti-Semitic behavior, not from government sources, but really from deep-seated suspicions of non-Russian population directed toward the Jews. Number three, you've had a very serious and very bothersome downturn in the economy and an unraveling of the social and political structure, making current life more and more unpalatable. And the fourth major element shaping Jewish life today is a great suspicion as to future instability in the country. All of those things put together, I think, are making the Jews, Soviet Jewry, much more assertive in terms of their right to practice their culture and their religion, and probably much more of the opinion that that can only be done outside of the Soviet Union, either in Israel or the United States.
Based on what you've seen over there and the things that you have heard from the folks you've talked to, what do you think the future course of that country is? Do you think it's really going to come apart at the seams, or is Gorbachev going to be able to hold it together?
For the past several years, all Sovietologists have been consistently wrong in their prognostications. If we can start from that premise, here is my general feeling from my recent trip.
That was Robert Aronson, a Minneapolis attorney in the firm of Ingber and Aronson, an expert in the area of emigration from the Soviet Union, specifically Jewish emigration.